I call this meeting the Judiciary Committee to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Members, today we will be having two overview presentations. The first will be from the Guardian Ad Litem Board, and the second will be from the Tax Court. And then we'll be hearing our first bill from Representative Daphne. So can I have a motion to approve the minutes from January 17th? Representative Johnson moves the minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Minutes of January 17th are approved. So we'll move immediately to the Guardian Ad Litem Board. We have a testifier at the table. Please identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent.
Good morning. My name is Kristen Treble Halbersma, and I'm the Program Administrator for the Guardian Ad Litem Board. Our Guardian Ad Litem Board Chair, Krista Parkin, had planned on attending, but lives quite a distance from St. Paul and was not able to make it due to the weather.
And I'm sorry, can you pronounce your name again? Say again.
It's Treble. Kristen Treble Halbersma.
Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'd like to start this morning by just talking a little bit about our agency, our program, and the services that we provide. And it looks like I need to go back. Okay, so the Guardian Ad Litem program provides child advocacy service for children that are abused and neglected and part of the court system. I'm going to start with a little bit of the history regarding the Guardian Ad Litem program. And as you can see with this slide, the Guardian Ad Litem program has undergone significant, almost continuous changes over the last 20 years. And given the amount of time that we have today, I'll just start with a couple of the key dates. In 2002, the state supervised and the judicial districts administered the Guardian Ad Litem program. And so each one of the judicial district administrators in the 10 judicial districts supervised the program. Following that, in 2007 and 2008, judicial counsel formed the Guardian Ad Litem Advisory Committee to look at long-term and systematic changes and challenges that the program had over their significant history. There were two major recommendations. The first recommendation was to move the program out of the court system and place it under its own independent board. The second was to discontinue the use of contractors and hire employees. In 2009, Judicial Council, again the governing body for the courts, decided to create an independent board and sought out legislation to establish the board. In 2010, the board members were appointed and the program administrator was hired. There are seven board members, three that are appointed by the Supreme Court and four that are appointed by the governor's office. Another significant date is in 2017, just last year, the Office of the Legislative Auditor completed a program evaluation. The statute that established our program is 280.35. And the statute, the duties and responsibilities in the statute are to administer a statewide independent guardian ad litem program to advocate for the best interests of children, minor parents, and incompetent adults in juvenile and family court. The program was established in the judicial branch, and like I previously mentioned, the board consisted of seven appointed members. All of those members are volunteers, and they provide significant services for our program. The board has both mandated and permissive duties, and I'll talk about those in a minute. Our board has gone through a significant realignment over the last year. And through that realignment process, they've reestablished our mission statement and our purpose. And so the updated purpose statement is that the Minnesota Guardian Ad Litem Program exists so that all children with a court-appointed guardian ad litem will have their primary needs met, and that each judicial officer is equipped to make informed decisions for each child within the confines of the available resources. The Guardian Ad Litem program also supports the statewide outcome of strong and stable families. So looking at the mandated duties of the board, there are four mandated duties. The first one is to approve and recommend to the legislature a budget for the board and the program. The second is to establish procedures for the distribution of such funding. The third is to establish standards, administrative policies, procedures, and rules, and then the appointment of the program administrator. There are two permissive duties that are outlined in statute. The first is to adopt standards, policies, and procedures necessary to ensure quality advocacy for the best interests of children. And the second is to propose statutory changes to the legislature and rule changes to the Supreme Court. As I stated, the guardian ad litem program is federally mandated. In 1974, Congress enacted the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which is referred to as CAPTA. To receive federal foster care funds, a state must enact and enforce laws mandating the appointment of a guardian ad litem on every juvenile court case alleging that the child has been abused or neglected. We currently are not in compliance with the federal mandate because our services have not been able to keep up with the increase in CHIPS filings over the last 4 years. We have received notification from the federal government that the Department of Human Services is potentially at risk of losing the CAPTA funds due to noncompliance with the federal mandate. A year after the federal mandate was enacted, Minnesota enacted guardian ad litem statutes as well in both juvenile and family court cases, Minnesota Statute 260C and Minnesota Statute 518. Again, compliance with federal and state mandates for appointment have been affected by the increase in CHIPS filings. So looking at the guardian ad litem role, there are five statutorily mandated duties that outline the responsibility and the role of guardians. The first is to conduct an independent investigation, which we do separate from social services. I know sometimes there's questions regarding how our role is different from social services. The second is to advocate for the child's best interest, maintain confidentiality, monitor the best interest throughout the proceedings. We are appointed at the beginning of the case and remain on the case for the duration. Present written reports that include conclusions and the recommendations based and the facts upon which they're based to the court. And it's important to point out that the guardian ad litem is the only independent voice representing the child's best interest during the court proceedings. This slide tells you a little bit about our base budget. Our budget, the base biennium budget, is just under $33 million. Our payroll consists of 85% of our base budget, with operations being approximately 15%. Many of our guardians work from home, have home-based offices, and they are provided a stipend to offset the cost of their office. In addition, our operations covers things such as mileage. Our guardians travel throughout the state, oftentimes to a number of different counties, visiting children and families in their homes. In addition, over the last year and a half, we have made some significant changes to our administrative structure and our operations to try to minimize costs so that our costs can go to advocacy for children. For example, we have 10 judicial districts, and each district had a manager. Over the last 2 years, we have combined four of the judicial districts. We've combined the 7th and the 8th under one manager and the 6th and the 9th to save on costs. Our program has approximately 206 FTE, equating to 255 staff and 275 volunteers. Our volunteer programs are in Hennepin in Ramsey counties and the fourth and the second judicial districts. Our central office staff is 5.55 positions, which is less than 3% of our full budget, which is a small percentage for the size of our program. As I mentioned earlier, case filings have increased significantly. Some of the laws were changed as a result of the governor's task force on child protection. And so over the last 4 years, child protection cases have increased 42%. Permanency cases have increased 69%. The majority of our work, almost over 90% of our work, is in juvenile court. So this has significantly impacted our ability to provide services for all children. There certainly have been some negative impacts as a result of the case filings for our program, which include waiting lists for permissive and mandatory cases. We currently have waiting lists in Hennepin and Ramsey County. I spoke in regards to the potential loss of the CAPTA funds due to lack of compliance with the federal mandate. The program is unable to comply with court-ordered requests for guardian ad litems, and judges are concerned regarding our lack of ability to provide services on all cases. Children of color are impacted due to the high level of unassigned cases in Ramsey and Hennepin County. And currently, we have approximately 264 unassigned cases and 477 children that do not have representation. As I spoke earlier in regards to the changes that we've made as many administrative structural changes as we can to offset the increase in cases. Like I mentioned earlier, last year, the Guardian Ad Litem program went through a program evaluation through the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And we believe that they have really, truly given us a roadmap to improve our program in regards to accountability and the advocacy that we provide for children. Over the last year, our board has gone through a complete realignment process. We have contracted with Minnesota Management and Budget Analysis and Development Agency to implement policy governance and update all of our board-level policies. The policies have, the update of the policies has allowed us to establish clear, measurable goals for program performance, and we now provide monitoring reports, which has increased accountability and performance measurements throughout the state. So every month we have a yearly calendar, and every month I provide significant data back to the board regarding performance measurements. In addition, we've implemented a learning management system to enhance our training and track our training and offer online training modules. We have four core training programs for our program. We have our pre-service or our juvenile court program that all guardians must go to prior to taking a case. We have our family court training program, domestic violence training, and ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act training. In addition to what has been completed related to the Office of the Legislative Auditor's recommendations, we are also in progress. We are working on updating all of our administrative policies, which we have approximately 60, and all of our standard operating procedures for our agency. We're also updating our case management system. We developed a case management system in 2015. We used to use the courts, Minnesota court information system, and as a result of creating our own agency and board, we had to create our own case management system. And so we're still in the process of providing enhancements to that system, which will allow us the infrastructure for real-time evaluations of our investigations. We're also updating goals related to diversifying our workforce. We have significant turnover in our workforce currently, as a result of high caseload levels for our guardians, as well as the what we're able to provide for compensation and salaries at this point in time. And so we're working on that, as well as goals related to bringing in guardians of color within our agency. We're also working on integration with the guardian ad litem case management system and the court's e-filing and e-service system, as well as other information from the court's information system. The work that we're doing with them will allow real-time dashboarding of compliance with our court report statutes and rule requirements, which was a recommendation from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So that's a very quick overview of our agency. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Tribble. Halversma, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, on average, how many cases can an ad litem handle?
Ms. Tribble Halversma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Most guardians have approximately 30 cases, and that's distinct cases. So that means that if there is a CHIPS case, in addition to a permanency case, in addition to adoption, that would count as one case. So it's a significant caseload size. That can range, if you look at it in terms of children, depending on the families that they work with, it could be anywhere from 40 to 65 children.
Thank you. Rips O'Neill? Is that good?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the complaint process, but I want to preface it by saying that these guardians, for the most part, do great work, and I have a secondhand experience with them from some friends of ours that have gone through trying to adopt their niece and that sort of thing. And it's our friends just sing the praises of the guardian ad litem that's helped them through that process. But I do want to talk a little bit about the complaint process, because I noticed on the one slide that's one of the recommendations from the legislative auditors, centralized complaint tracking.
Yes.
And can you tell me a little bit about the complaint process and where is there a time frame on getting back and following up on the complaints? Obviously, the ad litems themselves are overwhelmed with caseload. Does the complaint process, I'm assuming, is handled by an administrative process? But if you could fill us in a little bit on that.
Ms. Tribble Halbersma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Our complaint process was revised several years ago to include different steps within the process. We have information on our board website regarding our complaint process, and anytime we receive information from a customer or client wanting information, we direct them to the information. But we do have our managers review the complaints. Complaints are sent directly to the district manager for that particular area, and they do an investigation based on the information in the complaint. And we do ask for a written complaint with information on how they believe the guardian did not follow the statutory requirements of their role. So the manager investigates and then provides their written findings back to the complainant. At that point, they can ask for a reconsideration of the complaint, at which time it is again sent back to the manager, and they will do another investigation based on any additional information that is provided. And at that time, then they send the results, any findings, back to the complainant. The complainant can then ask for a third review of the complaint, and it goes to a panel review, and we have a board member, guardian ad litem, as well as a retired judicial officer from the courts review the panel or review the complaint and provide a panel response back at that given time. With centralizing the complaints, in the past, the districts kept all of the data in regards to the complaint process. Now it's brought back to our centralized office and stored centrally, and we do provide that information on a yearly basis through a monitoring report back to the board, so that they can review the types of complaints that we receive, as well as what the findings are and any responses to that.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that published anywhere? The results. I mean, obviously, you can't probably give names and particular case information, but can you give summary information? Is that public somewhere?
Ms. Tribble Halbersma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. It has not been at this point because we just went through this realignment process. We will be issuing an annual report in the future and putting data from our monitoring reports within that annual report. So to date, we have not published that because we're still in the transition. However, it may be published in the future.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Lesh. Ms.
Treblehausen.
First of all, I want to thank you for the work that the Guardians do. I've worked with them over my career, and everyone that I've worked with has been fabulous to work with. They truly look after the best interests of the child. What I'm going to speak now is most of the people on this committee were not on judiciary last year. I think there's only two people in this room. We went through the report last year, and we actually funded the majority of the things the audit reported. We had over $3.6 million for new employees and stuff, and also put another $4 million on the base to cover those employees. But unfortunately, Governor Dayton vetoed that bill. So this is a great need, and that we do need to look at getting them up to staff where they need to be.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Johnson. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you touch on what the educational requirements are for the job and the amount of total training before they go into the field?
Ms. Treble Halbersma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. The requirements are 4-year degree or education. or experience, I'm sorry, four-year education and or experience. And with the experience, we look at things such as working within the court system, working within the educational field, working with children. As far as the training that is involved, like I mentioned, we are in the process of revamping all of our training for the program. We do have a core pre-service training that all guardians must go through. It had been a 40-hour in-person training. We're in the process of creating online modules so that it will be provided online to our staff in addition to some face-to-face training. So we're not looking at it in terms of hours anymore, but in terms of completing different portions of it. With that training, we're increasing education regarding implicit bias, increasing our education for ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act training as well. And so all guardians must complete that before they are assigned a case. In addition, they do complete training on domestic violence, an additional 6 hours of training specific to domestic violence, before they would take any family court cases, they would go through a 32-hour family court training as well. And again, all of that training we're in the process of revamping and creating online modules for.
Thank you. Mayor Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to express a little concern that somebody going in and making recommendations to the court does not have an educational requirement when it gets down to it, and basically 40 hours of pre-service training before they're thrown in. That seems a little light to me, and this is something I actually have brought up the last two times. First time I was in 2015, they said, well, that time there was. They just put in a four-year degree requirement. Then 2 years ago, that disappeared, and it's 4 years or relevant work experience. I'm concerned about the level of training before they're walking into the courtroom and making recommendations, and I just want to...
Well, thank you for your comments, Chair Constant. I will say I share similar reservations. I'm in Florida in cases that I've handled involving juveniles and the coziness between the bench and guardians ad litem, which is just kind of pro forma. That said, I'm not sure that's our biggest problem to solve right now. I think it's a long-term problem to solve. Now, this is not the only time we'll be hearing from the guardians ad litem. So, you know, maybe we can talk about that. But I do think the funding issues are paramount. That said, I think your comments are well taken. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. I just wanted to just highlight for the committee here today that the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report that came out last year is worth the read. And I think to the administrator's point, there's some good recommendations there that everybody should familiarize themselves with. So not a question, just a comment. And I think it would provide a nice base for continuing conversations with the guardians.
Wrap-up question, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just did some quick back of the envelope kind of calculations, and I think we could probably plug this hole for about $1.5 million to $2 million at the most. So if we just use their numbers of actuals in the current budget cycle, it should be $1.5 million to come up with 10 more folks to do this. That's what the need is, because if they handle 30 cases, you only need 9, but if you throw in 10. But it's not unsurmountable.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that, mm-hmm. Ms. Treble Halversma, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming in today. This is one of the important areas that this committee will fund, so I'm sure we'll hear from you again, as well as Chair Parkin. And thank you for coming in and presenting before the committee today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, we have that tax court overview, which, despite what anyone says, I think is one of the most exciting courts. So please come on up and...
Good morning.
As soon as you're ready, please introduce yourself for the committee and begin your presentation.
Good
Mr. Chairman, I think you jinxed me on that one. So, good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Brad Della Pena. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. To my right is Judge Tamara Granvall, and further over is Judge Joanne Turner. We are the tax court. In addition to us, we have three judicial law clerks, essentially staff attorneys, and three administrators. We appreciate the opportunity to discuss the court's work with you today, but before doing that, I'd like to provide you with some brief institutional context. Just as you would expect, Minnesota's tax system involves all three branches of government. Legislative bodies create tax policies at the state and local levels, deciding what will be taxed and to what extent. Executive branch officials implement and enforce the law. At the state level, that's the Commissioner of Revenue. At the local level, it's county assessors. Finally, courts review enforcement activity to ensure that taxpayers are fairly treated. The legislature created the tax court specifically to perform this last function, to serve as a check upon state and local enforcement activities. Indeed, taxpayers initiate all of the approximately 3,000 tax court cases that are filed each year. As an additional guarantee of fairness to taxpayers, the legislature provided that tax court decisions, the output of this court, are directly reviewable to the Minnesota Supreme Court. That is an unusual exception circumventing the Court of Appeals. So tax court, Supreme Court, that's an appeal as of right. Nevertheless, most tax cases are finally decided by the Minnesota Tax Court, by the three of us. Only a relatively small proportion of those decisions are appealed. Particularly for purposes of this committee, it is important to note that the tax court resides in the executive rather than the judicial branch. Although this is so, the legislature adopted institutional arrangements to give the tax court true judicial independence. First, the court's judges are independent of the appointing authority. Once appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, tax court judges are not subject to removal by the governor. In addition, six-year terms ensure that an appointed judge will serve beyond the existing term of the appointing governor. Second, the tax court reviews final agency action. So that's a final order of the Commissioner of Revenue or a final assessment, rather than making recommendations to taxing officials before they act. That's common in the Office of Administrator Hearing model, where a quasi-judicial proceeding will occur issuing a recommendation to an agency head. For the tax court, the agency acts first, and that action is reviewed by the tax court and then, as I said, directly appealable to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Because our court reviews only final enforcement actions, it is truly independent of enforcement officials. The tax court's structural independence allows it to engage in genuine and searching review of all tax enforcement actions. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairperson. As my colleague, Chief Judge Della Pena, pointed out, the tax court's an independent court, meaning that its judges do not report to any commissioner or other officer of the state, and particularly do not report to the Commissioner of Revenue. The tax court thus provides an independent and nonpartisan avenue of appeal for a taxpayer who disputes the assessed value of their property or disputes an order of the Commissioner of Revenue for a tax, any tax-related issue. The jurisdiction of the court is limited to tax disputes, but as I'll explain, there's some variation on that. All right. As you can see from the slide here, our caseload has increased about 450% between 2000 and 2010, the year in which the filings peaked, in part because of the recession, or largely in part because of the economic recession. Since that peak in 2010, our caseload has decreased, but remains more than double what it was in 2000. And as you'll note, the tax court staffing has remained the same since 2000, I think even before that, for the last 19 years, despite this significant increase in appeals. The increase in property tax filings created a backlog of cases to be decided during the recession. Since that backlog, the tax court's made significant progress in reducing the size of that backlog and putting cases on a path toward timely resolution. So, as I've indicated, each case is now subject to a written scheduling.
Turner, I have a question. These property tax appeals, are these mostly valuation appeals?
Yes, sir.
Are any of them, like, aside from valuation appeals, what do they include?
Yes, there are. There are some cases, it's a much smaller proportion of cases that may relate to classification of a building, a residence, or land, agricultural land. And then there's also once in a while a claim of unequalization, essentially a claim that the valuation was outside the band of proper equalization.
Okay.
But the vast majority, I'm going to venture a guess, 99% are valuation of the property.
Thank you.
Each case is subject to a written scheduling order that requires the case to be resolved or ready to try within about 15 months. This winter, we've issued scheduling orders and property tax appeals concerning taxes that are payable in 2018, and scheduling orders are issued on a regular basis, so all the new petitions that come in get a scheduling order and they're moved toward and on a path of getting resolved. Appeals in the commissioner cases, as you can see from this slide, remain fairly constant. And then appeals and property taxes, as I've talked about, fluctuate quite a bit with property values. So you've heard a little bit about this already from my colleague, but cases filed with the court are nominally called appeals because what's triggered them are decisions of other government agencies, whether it's a county assessor, in the case of a property tax appeal, or the Department of Revenue in other cases. Of course, the vast majority of our cases, I think it's 98%, are property tax disputes. The tax court's jurisdiction extends to any real property located anywhere in the state. So we hear a very large variety of types of property tax cases. Some of these in cases involve the valuation or classification, typically valuation of department stores, shopping centers, single-family residences, parking ramps, downtown Minneapolis office towers. Historically, we've had some very large cases involving the valuation of timberland in northern Minnesota, the Ford Assembly Plant in St. Paul, warehouses, big box retail stores, residential building lots, an ethanol plant in southern Minnesota, and other industrial manufacturing facilities located throughout the entire state. As Mr. Chairperson pointed out, most of them are challenges to assess value, but taxpayers can also appeal the classification of their property and also challenge whether a property might be exempt from taxation altogether, whether it's a charity or a nonprofit.
Can I ask another question, Judge Turner? And by the way, I don't do this just to interrupt you because judges do that to litigants, right? So I don't do that just to interrupt them for karma. But I am wondering, do you see a trend between appeals from certain jurisdictions? Like, are they more common in some jurisdictions than they are in others?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. And I'm Judge Grunwald, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Well, we had it in the wrong order. I apologize, Judge Grunwald.
Okay,
thank you.
That's all right. I will answer your question, but I'll also defer to my colleagues to have the opportunity to answer that question. By volume, by far the most appeals come from Hennepin County and Ramsey County, so counties with both a lot of large number of residential properties as well as commercial real estate properties. And I would add to that the metro area. Very large portions of the state of Minnesota, the northern part of the state, for example, there's not a lot of private property. There's a lot of forest land and other land that's not privately owned. So to your question about where do we see the trends, I think the metro area counties really are the largest by far volume of our appeals.
Well, can I ask this? I mean, I'd assume that because that's where the population is, but do you see trends that skew beyond the population percentage? For example, I guess the question I'm asking is, do you see assessors either in counties or at the state being more hardcore about valuations, and do you see property owners reacting to that more than they do in other jurisdictions? It's kind of what I'm getting at.
I have not seen that. I will give the opportunity to either of my colleagues who've been at the court longer than I have, who may have a little bit more of a historical arc, to answer that question. I have not seen it, but I will defer to either of them to answer if they are able to.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we have heard anecdotally complaints about assessors in certain counties, but we can't tie those to any particular trend. So, and those complaints come from property owners, and again, they're just anecdotes. So, for example, a few years ago, the assessor chair in Scott County turned over, and we heard complaints from property owners informally that the assessor was taking a harder line than his predecessor had. But again, it's just anecdotally. We don't really have the ability. We can't calculate, for example, appeals as a percentage of the number of taxpayers who could appeal in a particular county because we don't know what that denominator is.
Understood. Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on a related note, do you keep data by county that we could see? I mean, we could probably establish if there are trends or not by looking at that data if you have it.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Judge De La Pena.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. We have available a county breakdown, so we can cut the data that way, and we could certainly make that data available to you. That's a result of the new case management system that you all have funded, so it's just one of the fields we can do searches across. We haven't done that.
Great. I'd like to see that.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. If we can get that to the committee. So good job on the funding, Chair Johnson. That was you, right? You funded it? All right, good job. And you know, the anecdotal evidence is important. Although anecdotally, you know, if you listen to this committee, you know, the Republicans think they're way overtaxed, right? So, and then Democrats not necessarily so much. So what I'd like to get a sense of, my real interest is finding out, you know, if there is an aggressive jurisdiction that is driving up filings more so than anecdotally, but of course anecdotally is worthwhile. Of course, I think I'm overtaxed in St. Paul too, but whatever. Did I just say that on the record?
Yes.
Okay, well, whatever. Okay, I'm sorry. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Turner, nice to see you again. Judge Grunwald?
Grunwald.
As you were given that list of different types, it appeared to me that a significant number of them were corporate. Could you hazard a guess as to how many of these appeals come from corporate entities versus citizens?
Yes.
Judge Grunwald.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yes, thank you, Mr. Or Representative. I would say there's two reasons. First of all, on any particular residence in a typical neighborhood or really in even a rural residence, usually the taxpayer is able to resolve the dispute about valuation with their county assessor. So even if they file a petition with the tax court, taxpayers are typically not saying their house is worth zero. They're saying it's not worth $200,000, it's worth $150,000. So the amount of tax that's at issue is really small. And it may not be worth their time to continue to pursue their appeal in tax court. Usually, from what we've seen is they are able to resolve that issue with the assessor. When it comes to corporate real estate, the valuations can vary so significantly that the difference between the, what the assessor says the building is worth, or even an expert appraisal says it's worth, and what the taxpayer may say it's worth, it could be the difference of $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, et cetera. So at that level of valuation, even if your tax rate is 3% or 4%, that's a significant amount of money. You may find it's worth it, or the taxpayer, the corporate taxpayer, may find it's worth it to hire an attorney, engage a law firm, pursue that case through litigation with the county. So in large part, it's because those cases have more tax dollars at stake, and they're able to afford an attorney and pursue it.
Chair Knutson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was asking, actually, though, was a percentage of your total cases corporate versus citizens. And that might not be something you even track. I was.
Judge Villapena.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, we could do a party search and try to discern how many of the total cases have parties that are corporations or are business entities. We don't tend to dice our data that way, but it's available on request, essentially. It's all public information.
You got another question, Chair?
No, just want to say thank you.
Okay, great, thank you. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Judge. Oh. I've heard a lot of this issue, especially in greater Minnesota, with the lot of the large corporations coming in to going to tax court, and it's hurting the cities and the school districts and the counties and the townships. My question is, I'm just wondering if you have any idea what percentage, what I'm hearing is it's high, but what percentage of the time is the corporate business is actually winning in tax courts? And if it is high, do we need to relook at how we value these properties so we don't have that problem in the future?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you have the answer as to a winning percentage, that's fine. You can give the answer. But I think the other question is more of a political question that I don't want to put to them. Do you have data on how much the corporations win?
We do not, Mr. Chair. We do not track that information.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll get back to you on that then, Chair Johnson, figure out where we're at there. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm not quite sure who would be the best person to answer this, but I'm going to play my freshman card here because I'm a new legislator. Being somebody who's fairly educated, I have a finance background, I have an MBA, I have a working in a doctorate in leadership, education leadership. I was unaware of all of the different systems that exist that allow people to sort of challenge different things that impact the quality of their lives, right? I'm curious as to know, what are the demographics of people who bring cases, and then how do we ensure that people who, like from myself with my background being a refugee, who have no social or cultural capital in different areas, political capital, how do they know about some of these things that they could even challenge the assessed values of their property? Because if I'm somebody who lives in the Frogtown neighborhood and I have no idea in that I can even do this if I need to, or if I, you know, I guess I'm just curious. There's so much that I don't know, so I just have a lot of questions, and this is nothing against any of the work that any of you have done. I just want to know more so that people from marginalized communities, people from low socioeconomic backgrounds, that they understand that there are processes in place in which they could challenge something that impacts the quality of their life as well.
Who wants to take that one? Judge Turner?
Thank you, Chairman. Representative, much of this process takes place long before the case ever reaches us. Mm-hmm. But early in each calendar year, each homeowner gets a notice from the taxing jurisdiction, typically the county, that tells them what their property will be valued at as of January 2nd of that year. And as part of that notice, they'll be told how they can challenge that value, both formally and informally. So Judge Granvall talked about sort of an informal process of contacting the assessor and seeing if they can work it out a different resolution. A member of this court did that successfully in St. Paul, was able to show the assessor that the assessor was wrong about the number of bedrooms in the house, gave the assessor a little tour, assessor agreed, yep, no four bedrooms here, I can only find three and adjusted the value accordingly. The other opportunity that the taxpayer has to resolve a dispute about value before it reaches us is through the local Board of Equalization. And each property owner is notified of when that board meets, typically meets in June of each year, so that assessed values are stabilized before the taxing jurisdiction has to create its budget for the next year. And all of that information, again, is provided to the homeowner by the taxing jurisdiction before it ever gets to us. And that's another opportunity for the taxpayer to resolve a difference over valuation or classification without actually going to litigation. But those are processes we don't control. It all happens before the case ever gets to us. In terms of what happens when the case reaches us, we have a lot of information available on our website for pro se taxpayers. We have a guide for how to present your case. All of that's available on our website. We send it to taxpayers on request. Our staff answers lots of questions about how to proceed.
Got it. Rips of her.
Thank you. That was really helpful because I don't know the process. I do just want to put out there that, this isn't your responsibility because you're right. There are processes that happen beforehand. But you did mention today that there are the most cases are in Hennepin and Ramsey County. Those are the two areas in which we have the highest diversity as well. And that if a piece of mail is coming to me in English and that is not my primary language, that's going to pose an issue to even participate in the process. So I would just like to put that out there in case there's any way that if you all do work together in the different systems, that it's feedback that could be provided at some point, or if there's places where I could go with this information to sort of provide that feedback, I'd love the opportunity to do that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Herter. I'm sorry. We'll get back on track here because we got Representative Dabney and his folks have been patiently waiting, and we'll try to limit the questions at least till we get done. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll move quickly through what I have left here. To some of the questions that came up, most of the property tax disputes, like most civil cases, are eventually settled. If the case can't settle, we hold telephone hearings on most motions, both for the convenience of the parties, as well as to keep our and the parties' travel costs low. Trials and property tax appeals are conducted in the county where the taxpayer lives, if they choose to do that, so we travel to the county where the taxpayer lives to hold that. Trial. So we really hear cases in all 87 counties throughout the state. All right, you've heard a little bit about what we do with the property tax cases. Just a word or two about the Commissioner of Revenue cases. Those are a smaller portion by volume of our docket, but that's another way in which we receive appeals. The tax court's really, for all practical purposes, the only avenue of appeal for orders from the Commissioner of Revenue. A taxpayer who disputes the assessed value of her property can appeal either to the tax court or district court, but the vast majority come to our court. For a taxpayer who disputes an order of the Commissioner of Revenue for additional taxes, the taxpayer typically, in almost all cases, comes to the tax court unless they pay the assessment in full and then go to district court and seek a refund. Those are pretty unusual. The appeals from commissioner orders can concern any tax administered by the Department of Revenue, so that includes sales taxes, gasoline taxes, estate taxes, state income taxes, and research and development credits, among several other tax taxes in Minnesota. Recently, we've heard cases involving the penalty for failing to timely file employee withholding statements, the issue of whether a business properly reported sales for purposes of determining the correct sales tax or use tax, an issue of whether a company's shareholder and officer can intervene in an appeal of a sales and use tax assessment against the company, and whether intercompany leases between two separate but interrelated companies are subject to use tax. And I'll stop there as for the sake of brevity. There's also a large range of cases that involve large corporate assessments or larger issues throughout the state. Commissioner appeals, as I mentioned, are a smaller part of the tax court's overall caseload, but are more likely to go to trial. More likely than property taxes, to go to trial for a couple reasons. More often, they contain complex issues of statutory interpretation, and at times issues of significant financial impact to the state of Minnesota. In other words, the outcome will affect all similarly situated taxpayers in Minnesota. The internal appeals process at the Department of Revenue resolves the vast majority of disputes before they reach the tax court, but that means that by the time they get to us, their parties are usually at loggerheads. All right. This slide shows published decisions and published orders over the last several years. You'll see that trials in tax court are to a judge and not to a jury. As a result, the court's judges prepare extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law supported by a memorandum of explanation. And in each case, that goes to trial and on each motion heard. As you heard my colleague mention a little earlier in the presentation, tax cases in regular division are directly appealable as of right to the Minnesota Supreme Court. In addition to issuing decisions, the court issues scheduling orders in each case as well, which helps the case move along in a timely and predictable fashion. One other thing I want to mention about what we do at the tax court is a few years ago, the tax court judges started offering free mediation to parties who are unable to settle cases through their own settlement efforts. All three of us have completed the extensive training required to be a qualified neutral. And as some of you, I'm sure, are well aware of, mediation is a method by which the parties are empowered to decide how they would like to mutually resolve their appeal and to their satisfaction. And sometimes it's in consideration of other issues. Sometimes these parties have ongoing relationships with each other, and it's important for them to feel empowered in the process and to find that the process was satisfactory. It saves the parties attorney's fees that they'd otherwise spend on motions, trial, post-trial briefing, and possible additional appeals. Most importantly, as I mentioned, it gives the parties certainty over the outcome of their appeal and the ability to preserve their relationship. We provide this service for free, and we've had some success with it. So that's something that that's newer to the tax court, but I'm excited to report. And I will turn over the next part of the presentation to my colleague, Judge Nointer.
Judge Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have what I think is the best part of the presentation, and that's an opportunity to thank the committee for what you've done for us in the past. We came to you 2 years ago and asked for funding and a few other favors, and I want to report to you on what we did with the money. First, we've completed replacement of the case management system. You wouldn't know that. It wasn't in the papers. There was no drama. We came in on Monday morning, and it worked. And that was about a year and a half ago. We've spent the last year and a half going through a couple of software updates, learning more about the power of the system and what it will do for us. We will have another major software upgrade next month, and once that has been fully implemented, we'll be in a position to begin to talk about public access, and I'll have a few things to say about that in a minute. We also asked you last 2 years ago to increase the dollar limit in our small claims division, which had been at $5,000 for decades. You increased it to $15,000 to match the dollar limit in conciliation court, and we're beginning to see the effects of that. Understand that many of our small claims cases are IFP already, so the filing fee doesn't really matter. They don't save anything because they don't pay the filing fee to begin with, but it means that the case can be resolved much more quickly and much more informally, particularly for a taxpayer who is pro se and really not very familiar with the court system. So thank you for that. 2 years ago, we asked for some money for a third law clerk, and you granted that. This is show and tell. So our two law clerks are here. Catherine Swanson comes to us from the Attorney General's office in the great state of Alaska, where she worked on pipeline matters. Before that, she clerked for the Alaska Supreme Court. And Elizabeth Zebarth is our newest law clerk, just been with us for a couple of months now. She comes to us from Mitchell Hamlin. Our third law clerk is in his second day of work, at KPMG in Dallas, where he's building their small claim, their state and local property tax practice. Our other former law clerks are, with the exception of one, all in private practice here in the Twin Cities. And many of you have met the remaining clerk, Alex Hagler, who's now with the House Research Department. So we could not be happier with the clerks we have. We couldn't be happier with the clerks that we've had, and we're delighted to see where they're winding up. Thank you, thank you, thank you for making that possible. 2 years ago, when we were here, we were a week away from the kickoff meeting with our vendor for the case management system. I can tell you that Thomson Reuters moved heaven and earth to compress a process that normally takes 15 to 18 months and was able to implement our case management system in 4 months. We went live at the end of June, and as I said, no drama. We came in on Monday morning, and it just worked. So with a case management system like this now, we're able to do some things that we'll be talking to you about this session. One is to provide public access or greater public access to our proceedings. Our system would allow the public to view our docket, for example, and a case management system is how we manage our inventory of cases. It tells us what cases are pending before us, who the parties are, how to reach them, who the attorneys are that represent those parties, how to reach them, and everything that's happened in the case since then. One of the questions that comes up in public access is how much of that information should be available to the general public. If I look at a district court action, for example, a case pending in the judicial branch, on the judicial branch's website, I can see who the parties are, I can see a list of what has happened in the case to date, but I can't see the parties' contact information, and I can't access the actual documents that have been filed. The judicial branch is subject to different rules. We're subject to the Data Practices Act. So one of the things that we'll be talking to you about, one of the conversations we'll need to have, is how much access to our proceedings should be available to anybody in the world with an internet access, particularly considering that we're talking about taxes and financial matters and, in some cases, medical information.
Judge Turner, if I can have you
Yes, Chairman.
Wrap it up.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. In this day and age, with sort of daily hacks of credit card companies and banks and everything else, we think that our information may be deserving of some additional protection. So 2 years ago, you authorized a statutory amendment that will allow us to implement e-filing with just a simple rule change, not statutory, and that's another thing we'll be working on in this coming biennium. And with that, I thank the committee and the chair for your time and attention.
Thank you very much, Judge Turner. Members, we're going to be hearing from the tax court again on their budget presentation when they do that, when it comes time for that hearing. We have a lot more questions for them. I told you it was an interesting court, okay? And this committee has had a lot more questions for them than I anticipated, hence we're way over time, and we will not be taking any more questions for them. I know Representative Lucero had a question. If you could submit that to them, and we can get the answer back from them offline. But I'd like to thank all the judges. Judge De La Pena, is it De La Pena or De La Pena?
De La Pena.
De La Pena, Judge Turner, and Judge Granval, thank you very much for your presentation. We look forward to hearing from you again. And Representative Dabney, if you could come forward with your folks and prepare. Members, because we are over time, there are two items. First, Representative Dabney was forced to sit through almost an entire meeting of the Judiciary Committee, which I know is not typically what he would look forward to. But second, we only have 15 minutes for what should be like a 30-minute presentation. Oh, we're going to 11:15? Oh, forget. Okay, we do have more time. I had thought we were ending at 11. So, Representative Dabney, if you could, Members, this is a bill, the subject of which was heard from by the Data Practices Commission last year. Some interesting areas that do involve property, zoning, etc. But Representative Dabney, please introduce yourself for the committee. One moment. What? Oh, we do have an amendment. Yes, the amendment that Representative Dabney worked out with the members of the State Bar Association property tax section, I think.
Mr. Chair, members of the real property section.
The real property section of the bar. Almost as exciting as tax court judges coming forward. They prepared this amendment, so apparently we have agreement, consensus on that. And members, that was passed out to you just about 10 minutes ago, so you have that too. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, what is the motion before the committee?
That's a great question.
We're all getting our sea legs under us.
Yes, yes.
Not,
we are.
Wrong thing to say to an Army man, I guess. But.
Where's it going? For what? Where's it going? Oh, we're going to the General Register. Yeah. Okay, so you're good. So do we have a motion to move Representative Dabney's House File 51 to the General Register? Thank you. And the motion is recommended to be referred to the General Register, right? Didn't we learn that in chair training? We're not recommending it pass. We're recommending that it be referred to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, I'll trust in the process.
That's what we're going to say. Refer to the General Register. Okay.
And then could someone please move the 51A3?
Unless you want to move. Okay. The chair will move it. Did you have a quick question, Representative O'Neill?
I do. Just procedurally, Chair. So how does the Ways and Means Committee chair play into all of our decisions and moving and all of that now? Because it's rather confusing to us, I believe.
If this bill had a fiscal note, which it does not, if this bill had a fiscal note, the referral would be vertically back to Ways and Means. I may get back to you on that, but I'm pretty sure that's what my answer is right now.
So, Mr. Chair, if it does not have a fiscal implication like in times past, does it still have to go through the Ways and Means Chair's purview before it could actually get to the General Register docket or not?
It does not.
Okay.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, has the committee voted on the amendment? I'm just trying to make sure that we're tracking everything.
Sure. So,
Has someone moved it and then has the committee voted?
We don't need any explanation on that, any further explanation, just that it's kind of a consensus amendment brought by the real property section of the bar. The chair will move the amendment. What's the number of the amendment?
A3
in order to get the bill in shape that the author wants. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes to the bill, House File 51, as amended, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. And I want to thank both the members of the real property industry who worked up that technical amendment, entirely technical in nature, but also particularly thank the committee administrator and Ms. Mullen for working over the weekend, over a long holiday weekend, to get the amendment in order. Members, the Twin Cities are among the leading nations in the country when it comes to racial gaps in home ownership. Our level of white home ownership is 76%, well above the national average of 64%, while our level of black home ownership is 23%, and for people of color more broadly, 40%, both numbers well below the national average. We're also a deeply segregated region with often distinct majorities of certain races and ethnic groups in certain neighborhoods and communities. While this segregation is often thought of as a historical accident or simply a matter of individuals choosing to live with folks like them, this de facto segregation has, in many cases, a de jure underlying base. House File 51 aims to bring light on one aspect of this de facto history of housing segregation, the use of racially restrictive covenants on residential housing, and provide today's homeowners with a path to respond. While these racially restrictive covenants are now illegal and unenforceable, they remain on the property titles and are a form of moral injury that House File 51 seeks to address. With me today is Kevin Ehrman-Solberg,
staff from the University of Minnesota's Mapping Prejudice Project. They're doing the country's, what I understand at least, to be the country's largest project identifying, mapping, and educating about the presence of these covenants. He can explain the covenants, the history, and their use. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dandy. Mr. Aaron Silbert.
Mr. Chair. So, as Jim, or Representative Dabney, I should say, but I am a member of the Mapping Prejudice Project. I'm the geospatial director, and we're located at the Borchardt Math Library at the University of Minnesota. And essentially what we're doing, and I'll talk more about this in a moment, is we're building the first comprehensive spatial database or map of racial covenants for any urban area in the country. So folks have looked at racial covenants before, but nobody's ever figured out exactly how many of these things there were, which neighborhoods were restricted, which ones were not restricted, how this connects with the ability of certain groups to purchase property and accumulate wealth through intergenerational property ownership, and who has not been able, who has not been afforded that ability. So what we're doing is, as I said, mapping these racially restrictive covenants. And racial covenants were legal clauses. They were entered into warranty deeds in the first half of the 20th century that prevented people of color from owning or even occupying property. And these are often just a couple lines of text, but they were incredibly powerful legal instruments. Now, I have here some examples of the language that you find in these things, and these are all from warranty deeds here in Hennepin County. And I do want to point out, while we are initially primarily focused on Hennepin County, we have found racial covenants in Duluth, Ramsey County, over by St. Cloud. Pretty much anywhere that we've looked, we found these things. So although I'll be talking a lot about Hennepin County in this presentation, that's what we're focusing on. This is very much a statewide issue. This was not a practice that was located strictly in the Twin Cities. But some of the examples of the kind of language that you find in these deeds are, you see on the screen, things like no persons of any race other than the Aryan race shall use or occupy any building or any lot. And this particular deed, by the way, is from 1946, after World War II. We have another one that says, neither shall said property be transferred or leased to a colored person. The said premises shall not at any time be sold, conveyed, leased, or sublet, or occupied by any person or persons who are not full bloods of the so-called Caucasian or white race. So this language is incredibly and explicitly racist. It's also incredibly powerful. Because these restrictions are inserted into warranty deeds, these covenants tract with the land and not the individual owner. It's kind of a weird concept, but essentially what this means is if in 1910 I buy a house, throw one of these restrictions on there, 10 years later I sell this house to a white person, 10 years after that they sell it to a white person. 10 years after that, that person sells the home to somebody who isn't white. Even though I've never met that person, they have breached the terms of the covenant. I can sue for forcible reentry, and the property would revert to me, the initial granting party. If at this point I was dead, it would revert to my heirs or assigns. So once these things got into the property record, they were incredibly powerful, and it took multiple federal Supreme Court rulings combined with federal legislation and also state legislation to finally make these things illegal. And this is a map showing the spread of covenants. This is kind of our work in progress, if you will. It's a time-enabled map, so each one of these blue dots that you see is an individual property parcel that had one of these racial restrictions attached to them. And if you look, it'll be on your top right. It'll show the year. We've mapped over 17,000 racial covenants in Hennepin County alone. We've identified over 30,000. We are still a work in project. We're not done yet. So even though there's a lot of blue on this map, right, there's a lot of restricted land here. If anything, this is grossly underestimating the total amount of restricted land. We simply haven't been able to map all of the restrictions yet. Hey, so why are we doing
it? Erman Solder?
Oh, yes, please, sorry.
I have a question. Like, I don't really know what Caucasian is or what Aryan is or, I mean, I guess white. I guess I have to check the white box on the form, sure, even though it looks weird on there. But I'm two-thirds Irish. So would I be able to buy a house? I mean, I'm pretty sure Irish aren't Aryan, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, but that's not Aryan, right? I mean, what? I mean,
well, and that's a live question during this period. In fact, there are Supreme Court rulings that are trying to determine what does and does not constitute being white or being Caucasian. I will point out I only read a few examples, but we found others that are more enumerative in the kind of categories they list. One in particular prohibits Chinese, Japanese, Turkish, Moorish, Negro, Mongolian, or African blood or descent, and that is a quote from the deed. We haven't found anything that targets any European group specifically. So there haven't there's a few dozen anti-Semitic ones, although it's much less than 1%. There was actually a state law passed in 1919 that prohibited real estate discrimination on religious grounds. Racial discrimination, of course, was still legal and widely used well into the 20th century, but religious discrimination, not so much. So as to your question, no, the Irish were not specifically targeted in any of these covenants. As to whether or not being Irish or Italian or Greek, for example, if that means you are or are not a member of the Aryan race, I can't answer that. I think it kind of speaks to the ridiculousness of a lot of this kind of racial categorization in the first place. So that's the best answer that I can give you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. Thank you for that answer. I'd point out, members, that I just learned the Republicans have caucus at 11, and I hadn't realized that when I pointed out that we could go to 11:15. So I understand some of you members may need to leave. As I understand it, DFL does not have caucus we don't have pre-session caucus. We don't have pre-session caucus. Okay, so my apologies. We'll get this worked out in a future committees. Please continue, Mr. Ermansolder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So kind of really quickly then, one thing that I do want to point out, this is a map showing where African Americans are living in Minneapolis in 1910. This is an important year. This is when the first covenant goes into effect. And the area with the highest percentage of black residents, it's near north, and it's only about 17% African American. But by 1940, this picture looks super different, right? We now have majority-minority neighborhoods for the first time in the city's history. Emerging black communities, which existed in 1910 in places like the shores of Lake Harriet, down by Lake Nokomis and along the river, are completely wiped out. And the black population is actually staying pretty consistent between 1910 and mid-century. It's about 1% in 1910. It's about 1% in 1950. So this concentration that you're seeing is not the result of like an influx of new residents into the city, right? Rather, this is pushing people out of existing communities in the city and concentrating them in small sections. And racial covenants specifically are one of the driving forces behind this this re-amalgamation. I would also like to point out that covenants are primarily being put into place by developers, not individual property owners. So what's happening during this period is kind of agrarian land, farmlands getting bought up by developers. It's being divided into municipal lots. Developers are throwing these restrictions on there. So this is an aerial photograph, South Minneapolis, 1938. Each one of these red rectangles is a lot that was restricted prior to this photograph being taken. So the first thing developers are doing before the roads are extended into the margins of Minneapolis and into the suburbs, before utilities are brought out, before power lines, the land is being racially restricted. This is kind of this preventative tactic to ensure that as the city is growing during this period, that growth is really restricted strictly to white folks. And why does this matter today, right? So covenants have been illegal since 1968 with the passage of the Fair Housing Act. So why are we still talking about this? Well, it turns out that although covenants are illegal, they're actually still very determinative of where people do and do not live in the city today. So Minneapolis, on average, is 53% white. Homes that had racial covenants placed on them, those are about 80% white, right? So this is almost a 30% difference, which is significant. Covenants have also had a significant impact on how property has appreciated or depreciated in value through time. So this map shows the property values today of areas that were historically redlined. And remember, I'm not sure if you're familiar with redlining as a practice, but the federal government did this in the 1930s. It had to do with who could and could not get mortgages, and they explicitly redlined areas because non-white people were living there. And the median value of homes today that were redlined historically, it's about $156,000. The city median, by the way, is $220,000, so significantly underperforming in relation to the city median. Areas that were covenanted, on the other hand, have shown the kind of exact opposite, right? These are significantly above area median and about 50% higher than homes that were historically redlined. So again, even though covenants themselves have been illegal now since at least the late 1960s, we're still very much living with the legacies of these restrictions, both in terms of where people do and do not live, so in terms of segregation, but also in terms of the segregation of wealth, which families have and have not been able to accumulate wealth intergenerationally through property. And in the interest of time, if you're interested in more of this, by the way, we do have a website, mappingprejudice.org, tons of more data and maps if you're into that sort of thing. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ermansolder, for that presentation. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I think the history speaks to itself. What House File 51 seeks to do is provide homeowners who find restrictive covenants on their titles an opportunity to place an affidavit on that title rejecting the underlying covenant. I want to be clear, it does not remove the covenant from the title. That's important in a couple of ways. One, the title, of course, is a historical document that's important to establishing ownership and the sequence of ownership, and we wouldn't want any action to cloud the title. That could be problematic for the sale of the house later and other legal aspects to it. Also, these folks are primarily historians, a little bit of geographer, too. They want the historical record to remain intact so that future historians in 50 years or something can look at these and ask a different set of questions than the set of questions they are asking today. So preserving the record for multiple important reasons, but allowing homeowners to respond to the moral injury that these racially restrictive covenants present.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions for the author or testifiers? No questions. You guys had tons of questions for the tax court. Chairman Adams.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, thank you for this bill, Representative Dandy, for your work at the University of Minnesota. You know, a few years ago, I looked at a map. It was at the Minneapolis School District. It was upstairs. It was a map of the pre-Highway 35 construct. And what struck me was that where Highway 35 was intentionally designed to run was right through the heart of the small African-American community in South Minneapolis, somewhat to what happened here in St. Paul with the Rondo corridor. And so I mentioned all to say that this issue of manipulating intentionally, not, you know, just like, you know, it just happened, but intentional manipulation of our space and opportunities for people of color and indigenous people is a historical process. And I think everything we can do to shed light on that process and to undo the harms of that, including undoing whatever remains in law that would even remotely validate that mindset, is critically important. It's important for all Minnesotans. It's especially important for the people of color, indigenous citizens and residents of our state. So I want to thank you for this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Seeing no other questions. Oh. Representative O'Neill.
Just real quick, because we do have to get to caucus, but I just wanted to remind the GOP members that former Representative Sarah Anderson had this bill before, and we were hugely supportive, and I do thank you for bringing it forward again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Neuer's motion is on the table that House File 51, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Chair,
members. Members, there being no other business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.